I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Tom Hawthorne joins me today in person. The Victoria-based journalist is the author of a new book, Deadlines, Obits of Memorable British Columbians. It's a wonderful collection of some of the obituaries Mr. Hawthorne has written over the years, read in various publications such as Reader's Digest, Canadian Geographic, and fairly regularly in the Globe and Mail. The deadbeat, if you will, is his. Although he writes about other subjects, he's one of those writers who, when his byline appears, many gravitate to see who he's writing about. The life lived will sometimes be famous, sometimes infamous, but always fascinating afterwards. In this book, we have eccentrics as well as innovators, heroes, and rogues. I'll get Mr. Hawthorne to tell us about some of the people featured in this book, as well how he practices his craft and the need for this sort of writing in our newspapers and elsewhere. Tom Hawthorne is an award-winning journalist who has won several prizes from the Society of Professional Obituary Writers. In a 2004 profile of him in the Victoria Times columnist, he is written about thusly, quote, "Merry hazel glints enliven his brown eyes, and he seems heartily enthusiastic in his approach to life. He's no Dr. Death, no crepe hanger, this guy. He's a dedicated family man with an ordinary household and a lively dog." His website is at tomhawthorne.blogspot.ca. This book is from Harbor Publishing. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Plant on the Line program in studio today, Tom Hawthorne. Mr. Hawthorne, good morning.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. I understand it was a hectic flight coming in here.
A bit bumpy flying in from Victoria over the waters.
Yeah, I guess it's the weather, is it?
It's, you know, it's rainy, it's cloudy, it's November in British Columbia's coast. It's always great to get a view of where we live from up above.
Yeah, no, you worked at the province for a few years, right?
I worked at the
Sun as well, right?
I briefly worked at the Vancouver Sun. Started at the Vancouver Sun when I was a kid at age 19 as a temporary reporter. Worked in Eastern Canada, then came back, worked at the province for 7.5 years in arts and news and sports, and went to Victoria, gosh, about 15 or 16 years ago.
Yeah, and so what brought you there? I guess journalism, right?
Kids.
Really?
We'd gone over to visit some friends in Victoria, and they had their kids, and they were leading this Leave It to Beaver life, and Vancouver was, we had a very nice house on the east side Vancouver, but, you know, the problems of the city were getting to us a bit, and we just thought, wow, let's see if it happens in Victoria. And there was just, by absolute circumstance, there was a job opening at the Times columnist, so over we went.
Yeah. When did you start writing obituaries? Was that at the Times columnist? Was that when you ended up at the Globe?
Well, most reporters starting out, you're assigned to do obituaries, and so, again, probably the first obit I ever wrote would have been for the Vancouver Sun. There was a Night City editor named Bruce Smiley, who we all really liked, called Mr. Nightside. And he would work in the docks in the day, and then he'd come out and put out the paper at night. And he would tell us young reporters that on a slow night, if you looked at the paid obituary notices in the paper, you'd find a story. We didn't pay any attention to that because we were ambitious, and everybody, you know, in the newsroom culture, the obit writer is not well regarded, and so we didn't pay attention. Later on, when I was freelancing, I started doing obituaries for the Globe and Mail in particular, and found that it's a fascinating opportunity to tell stories.
Yeah, and I guess that's how most people who know about you have sort of known about you, I guess, is they remember you from these pieces. And so how does it work? When someone dies, does an editor say, come to you and say, we'd like a piece on...
Working with the Globe, it's mostly worked the other way, where I let them know that somebody of interest has died. They have one staff writer at the Globe Mail who does obituaries, Sandra Martin. She has a book out this year as well. And so she is the staff reporter that does it. They sometimes ask other members of staff to do it. Again, like I said, in the newspaper culture, it's not seen as a good thing, so a lot of people don't do it. But they have a series of us freelancers across country. There's Joan Sullivan in Newfoundland and myself out here, Ron Sillig in Toronto. They have Philip Fine in Montreal, who contribute on and off to the obituary page of the Globe and Mail. So almost like we're scouting out there looking for people of interest to a national audience.
That's a great page, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people read that.
It's incredible how popular the obituary page is. Yeah. Maybe that's because we've reached a certain age, because when I was a kid, when I was in my 20s, I don't remember really paying much attention to the obituary page. But, you know, I'm in my 50s now. I've lost some friends. I've lost family, as well, most of us have. And what's on that page is of interest.
In terms of how, in this book, there are 50 of them. So in terms of how you write about the people, I suppose you've written about these people soon after they died, right?
Mostly it's within, certainly within a month. Sometimes it's, you know, the day they've passed, we're on the phone and doing stuff.
Had you met any of these, the 50 that are in the book?
There are a handful in there that I had met beforehand, and generally I think those are the better stories.
Yeah.
It's a mystery. It's a journalistic mystery that you try to solve when you're doing an obituary, because the one person who can answer every question you could have isn't with us anymore.
Right.
And that's the challenge, is to solve that. So when there are people that I've met before, Billy Kelso, the singer, Jimmy Babyface McLarnon, the boxer, it's a little easier to tell their story. A little sadder, too, because I've met them.
Yeah. Do you and Sandra Martin at the Globe and the others that you've mentioned earlier, do you guys operate like the character in The Imperfectionist, the novel, the Tom Rockman novel, where you interview someone ahead of time?
They do that. I haven't done that very much.
Yeah.
The major newspapers do that. They need to be prepared when, especially a particular famous person, a politician, passes. So the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Globe and Mail, the wire services like Canadian Press and the Associated Press, they will all have prepared in advance obituaries of prominent people. The Associated Press was in the news not too long ago because somebody had asked them, and they had replied truthfully that they had, in fact, prepared an obituary for Lindsay Lohan, mm-hmm. Who had fallen on hard times. And it was a bit shocking for people to realize mm-hmm. that that's what newspapers do. One of the more interesting events in all of this was a few years ago, a humorist died, and the New York Times had... Buchwald had passed away, and the New York Times had interviewed him before his death, and with a videotape that they showed on their website, and it starts with, "If you're seeing this, I am dead." So it was his effort to get the last laugh. Yeah. And that really changed, I think, for a lot of people, the approach to obituaries, that it's an acknowledgement. It is the one inevitability for all of us, is death. There's death and taxes. Well, you know, Mitt Romney can show you that you don't always have to pay taxes, but death is inevitable. And it was good that he did that, I think, because it opened up the world of for people to prepare in advance articles and know that people will die and that we'll be reading about them.
Yeah, what I like is when someone famous dies, we inevitably go to the New York Times to read the obituary. Someone, you know, like a celebrity or something, like Elizabeth Taylor or Bob Hope, and those two in particular. The obituary writer had died before the subject, and so there was the little line at the bottom that said, you know, so-and-so died, you know, whatever year, 5 years ago or so.
Yeah. The Globe also has, because they have so many prepared, there was a fellow who did those, and he's been gone 10 years now, and sometimes, very rare occasion as well, his byline will appear with that similar note. I have to tell you, as a writer, I kind of like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's good to know that your work will be ready even when you're no longer around, but...
Yeah.
It's one of the things, an oddity of the biz for sure.
Yeah. Do you have some prepared? Like, I mean, say a former premier or someone like that. Do you have that sort of a skeleton sort of notes and things like that?
I don't myself, but certainly Sandra Martin at the Globe would be a staff job generally that they would do. The Washington Post has asked me. I've done one obit for them. They've asked me to prepare a couple for Canadian prime ministers.
Yeah.
Because they'll want to have something ready, somebody who's familiar with Canadian politics, having prepared that in advance.
We haven't talked about the book yet, and you'll pardon me because I'm not a journalist, so I find that this craft just fascinating. In the obituary, and I guess there's some in the book where you do this, are there, I don't know what you call them, things that you break, say, about the person's life in the obituary?
Sometimes there are. I've found out things about some of the subjects of obituaries that the family didn't know. Certainly, often Second World War veterans came home and they never talked about what they did. And so you would go and talk to the regiment or look at the regimental history and find out what they did. And often the family has been surprised. So yes, you do on occasion. It also works in reverse. I've been contacted by people saying, perhaps you want to write about my father. He died. He played in the NHL. And then you look it up, and he didn't. Not that he lied or anything, but the family has misinterpreted his description of what he had done.
Yeah. So there are 50 in this. Now, how did you choose this? Did you choose all 50, or did Harbor, or how did that work?
I selected. I've written several hundred, probably 500 obituaries over the past decade of British Columbians. I originally selected 75 to fit the space of the book. We whittled it down to 50. There's some good people didn't make the cut, I'm sorry to say. Yeah. And we were also looking for a balance. I could have done one all of sports figures. So we were looking for a balance and wanted to have some eccentrics and some innovators and some business people and make sure that we reach, important groups in the province weren't missed out entirely. So it was a bit of a juggling act to make the final selections.
Yeah, and there are some people in here. I mean, there's some heroes and the sort. There's some really likable people. But there are also some people that don't engender much sympathy. People like Dave Stupich or Gilbert Paul Jordan.
Yeah.
I guess in the case of people like that, I mean, fairness is the key, right, for you as a writer?
Absolutely. It's one thing that as a writer and a reporter, what I owe to the family is fairness and accuracy. These aren't written for the family. They're written for the general reader. So, and it's part of the recorded history of a life. So I owe it to be, honest about who the people were. So there are a handful of scoundrels in the book. There's one villain for sure, Gilbert Paul Jordan, who was a mass killer. And then there's people who just ended up on the wrong path. Dave Stupich, a politician who did some good, but it lost his way at some point.
Yeah. One obituary that I knew nothing about this guy, but I've heard of the event. I'm going to pull the quote here. Steve Brody.
Steve Brody.
Can you tell us about him?
Steve Brody is one of these people that when you realize that they've passed away, I thought he had died years and years ago, and I was very sorry that I missed him.
Yeah.
And I tracked down his family. Steve Brody, there was a famous incident in Vancouver in 1938. We're in the midst of the Depression. There are many unemployed men on the streets. There is very little relief for them. And these men occupy the post office downtown, which we now know as the Sinclair Center.
Right.
And they have a fairly peaceable occupation. It's very organized. Other men have occupied the Hotel Vancouver, which was in a different location at that time. And they're fairly well organized. They issue newsletters and papers and do regular commentary, and they share their resources and feed each other, and no damage at all to the post office. Eventually, the people that run the city decided they wanted them out. The police attack it. While they're being attacked, the people inside the post office decide that they're no longer obliged to protect what's there because tear gas is being thrown, so they end up breaking glass windows. The last person out of there is the organizer, Steve Brody. He comes out, and the police beat him within an inch of his life. They knock out teeth. They damage an eye. They break bones. They refuse to allow people to take him away. Essentially, he's in the gutter, close to death. He's eventually rescued by people who cart him, other workers take him to the hospital, and he survives. And in some ways, perhaps the beating even saves his life because when war breaks out, he wants to go off and fight the Nazis, of course.
Yeah.
But he's got a bad eye, so they won't take him in the military services, and he ends up doing the Merchant Marine.
Yeah, and what I found just beautiful in your piece on him, and I'll read the last paragraph. Usually shows get the author to read it, but I'll read it, and I'll butcher it because it says it's beautifully written. I think it's instructive of what you're trying to do with this book and the work that you do. Quote, "The post office he occupied so many years ago is now home to upscale boutiques. The doorway is once again temporary refuge for the homeless. Unlike in Brody's day, they are unorganized and without hope." I mean, that is just, that's gorgeous writing.
Yeah, thank you. I was thinking about how, I think many of us, especially in Vancouver and Victoria, we have the same problem, is we don't know how to deal with the homeless.
Yeah.
I don't know how to deal with the homeless. It breaks my heart to see people living on the street in that, and I find it hard to enjoy my own wealth, such as it is, when people are in that way. And it just struck me that that very building where Steve Brody had tried legally to better the aid of people like him who were unemployed and had no money is still a place where the people are dumped on the street and are left behind. And I don't have answers for what to do, but it just struck me that here's the same problem 70 years later.
Yeah, and I guess you use these obituaries to talk about something contemporary almost. And I think that's what's instructive about obituaries in general and why we should look back, right? And why there is a need for this sort of writing in our papers, whether they be local or national.
Absolutely. I moved to Vancouver in 1977. Our family came out here from Eastern Canada like Okies, and I'm not kidding. We had what we had in the car and in the trailer, that was it. We had never been here before. It was a chance for a new start. And picking up the paper, which I bought every day, we would buy every day and read, even the obits in those papers told me who had been in the community that I should have known about.
Exactly.
And that's the role that the newspaper plays. Now, some papers run fewer obits these days. I mean, certainly the Sun runs fewer than they used to, and I'm disappointed by it. I know there's lots of pressures on papers. I wish they did to remind people of who matters. Jim Lorimer just died. He was an NDP cabinet minister, responsible in part for the C-bus and other things. He's worthy of a story, and I'm not sure he'll get the attention he deserves. He may not be worthy of a national story, but certainly in Vancouver we should remember.
Yeah, and you do that in this book. I mean, Fonsi Police. I'm a little younger than when he was on the street taking people's pictures. But I mean that's something that's a part of the social history that people ought to know about that was once there, right?
There's absolutely, and it's great to see Fonsi Police is actually getting a bit of a comeback. Some people have started a Facebook page where they're asking any readers to send in their photos of their family with Fonsi. Let me just tell people what Fonsi did. Yeah. He was a street photographer. There used to be a competing street photographers. He ended up buying them all out because he was very good at it. And he would just set up on Granville Street, or Georgia, but mostly Granville Street, and photograph people walking by, passersby walking by, and then he would hand you a card saying, come see me in the morning, you can look at the negatives and purchase them. And it's hard to imagine this in an age where we all have cell phones and cameras, but that's how he made his living. And in fact, families would come down for formal portraits because they couldn't afford a studio photographer, and they would have Fonsi take their photo. Fonsi was absolutely non-discriminating. The only color he cared about was money, and so he would photograph all kinds of people. He did not care. African-American musical acts, the Mills Brothers, for instance, other people like that would come up, Aboriginal families, Chinese-Canadian families. People who experienced discrimination on the streets of Vancouver were treated as absolute equals by Fonsi Police. And I think Fonsi probably had a sense himself, being Italian-Canadian, and especially when the war broke out in the Second World War and Italy was an enemy, of what it was like to be discriminated against. And so he's got this great legacy and an incredible social history of what people wore and how they walked and what they were like on the streets. And Fonsi Police was a great guy. I have the dimmest memory of seeing him not long after we moved here working on the streets.
Yeah. The other poignant piece that I in the book is the piece on Frank Howard. And if you read BC political history, I mean, he's sort of mentioned. But what I found fascinating was you mention in the obituary, and I don't know how well known this was other than from your writing. He was an MP, wasn't he?
That's
right. And so while he was running for office or something like that, there was an extortion plot against him. And then the name of the he was since convicted and extortionist, and I think he did time, didn't he? The person who had extorted Howard.
No, he didn't do time.
But he was
convicted and got a suspended sentence.
He paid his debt to society, essentially. But the name seemed familiar to me in reading it. And then I looked it up, and he's a fairly well-known editor in this town. Things like that. I mean, how did you find... I mean, was that well-known at the time? I guess it was, wasn't it?
No, I don't think it was all that well-known. I knew this was the incident in Frank Howard's life. Frank Howard, again, another incredible life. He was born to a prostitute. His father was likely the pimp. They gave him up right shortly after birth. He had no idea about his identity till much later in life. Got in a lot of trouble as a kid. Became involved at some point in armed robberies in the city of Vancouver during the war. Never fired a weapon, but he certainly carried it and was convicted. On coming out, just as war was ending, all the veterans were returning home and he couldn't get a job. So he decided to go by yet a different name, which was Frank Howard, as opposed to the name he was convicted under. Uh-huh. He becomes this politician, a fairly popular politician, and a guy who really stood up for poor people and very admirable in such. And a guy who was also a voice for Aboriginal people at a time when not many white politicians were. In the middle of all this, he's blackmailed and... this is exposed, and it was a huge front page story in the Vancouver Sun at the time. And Frank Howard purchased time on a local television network to state his case, and essentially ended up paying no price for this at all. He wasn't punished by the voters. He was reelected. The fellow who did it was I would describe again as a troubled young man of 18. His sentence was suspended. And the name was familiar to me. It just rang a bell, and so I looked it up and then talked to him.
Yeah.
And he was not happy that I was reviving this mistake of his past. But at the same time, it almost echoes Frank Howard's life, where Frank Howard had done something wrong, had done his time, and had made up for it. And this fellow has as well. But I will share that he was not happy.
Yeah. The 50 that are in this book, not all of them obviously are born in this province, but they have a connection to British Columbia.
Yeah.
So taken as a whole, do you think that there's something that's said about this place through their lives lived?
I think so. It's, you know, I've lived in 5 of the provinces in Canada. My mother's from another one. She's from New Brunswick. My father's from Manitoba. I've lived everywhere. I've been to only 9 of the provinces. Unfortunately, I haven't made it to Newfoundland yet. So I feel very Canadian, and I've always been keen on Canada. British Columbia is an absolutely unique place, in part because of the geography of it, in part because of the isolation of people who live outside the big cities. And I think, I mean, I'm a city boy, and I think there's a particular and peculiar culture to Vancouver itself and Victoria. That they're quite different. And if you talk to old-timers who are out of New Westminster or even neighborhoods of New Westminster, like Queensborough, I have a friend who's a Queensborough nationalist, you can see that all these people are different. And I hope it's reflected in the book how different we are. And you know, some people in the book are bush pilots. There's Margaret Fain Rutledge, an aviatrix who decided to become a pilot, a woman pioneer. Absolutely, and I really do hope that it captures that sense. And I think that's why Harbour wanted to publish this, because they've made, Howard White and the people at Harbour have made a long, decades-long commitment to telling British Columbia stories to British Columbians.
Yeah, and in terms of, back to the craft, if you will, have you thought about how you'd like to be written about?
I'm not worthy of being written about.
I doubt that very much.
I'm just a journalist. I like when people put obits in the paper, so I hope if I don't get around to it, or if I go before I have a chance, I hope my family puts one in.
Yeah.
I've had friends that have died. We had a neighbor that died, and she wrote her own obit and named several of us in the obit, and it was both heartbreaking and heartwarming that she cared so much that she would mention us. So it's something people should think about. They should consider what they want said when their time has come.
And how is it like for you as a writer? I mean, in the back of the book, you mentioned your father, and he died 10 years ago, right?
Right.
Did you write his obituary?
The paid notice in the newspaper, yes, I had to do that. He died suddenly, so that's the worst of the circumstances one could imagine. It was difficult, and I've had to write obits, news obituaries for friends. David Grierson, who was a much-loved radio host in both Vancouver and Victoria, died suddenly at the age of 49, and that one was, I can assure you, was written through tears. The fellow had been in our house that week. It's terrible.
Yeah. Are there, because I asked you earlier about how long after the person's died that you've written the piece. So looking back, are there obituaries that you wish you could have written? I mean, you can't really go back and write W.A.C. Bennett's today. I mean, it would be very different than if it were in 1979, right?
Right. You know, so these are mostly for newspapers or magazines, so there's a timeliness that's involved. I mean, you could write a biography of W.A.C. Bennett, and in fact, I would think, you know, if memory serves, he died in 1979, and the passage of years is such that it would be worthwhile to have another look at his life, because I think many people on the left certainly were very harsh about W.A.C. Bennett in his lifetime, and they may have a kinder view of him in the passage of those years. But yes, most of these, that's why we settled on the title Deadlines, because they are, some are done the day. You have to ram them in the paper the next day, and it's a bit of a scramble. Happily, the Globe kind of follows the British model, that unless somebody is absolutely famous, like top-notch Hollywood star or a former prime minister, it's worth it to take the time to get the story told, right? So that can last up to a month. The practice in American newspapers is that the obit must run before the actual service. So they scramble a bit more than we do. I prefer the British tradition that it's worth it to take the time to tell the story. It's your last chance to tell somebody's tale.
Yeah.
So you got to get it right.
Now, I read online, a lot of people were commenting on Twitter and Facebook about you in the last month or so. What's the relationship with the Globe and Mail now?
Well, I was been writing a, for 7 years I wrote a twice a week column, a human interest column, very rarely about dead people.
Yeah.
On occasion, I wrote about people who passed away, but mostly just profiles. I would like to have profiled you, in fact, Joe, sitting here, and people should... I know what the basement looks like. It is floor to ceiling of tidy books. Looks like mostly nonfiction, stacks of DVDs and CDs.
It's a mess.
It's not a mess, actually. I like it. This is kind of my dream. And so I would do stories like that about British Columbians who are doing interesting things or life, expressing life as it's lived in British Columbia. The Globe, like many newspapers these days, is struggling to make money and break even, and so they've had a cutback in their freelance budget, and that meant my column is no more. At least it's in abeyance. Would be the happiest circumstance. But it was a great run for 7.5 years. I got to tell all kind of people's stories. Thoroughly enjoyed it, and I still write for the Globe, but we'll see what happens next.
Yeah, and you're active on Twitter, and you have the blog, right?
That's right, and I write for many clients, smaller magazines and newspapers.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, as you came in here today, I'm a big fan of your writing. I've been following you for years, and so we need to see more of you, I think, and we'll be following you on Twitter and on the blog, of course, I urge people to pick up this book. It's such a great book. Thanks for coming in to do this.
Oh, thanks for having me, and thanks for those kind words.
You're very welcome. The website for more, tomhawthorne.blogspot.ca. The book is called Deadlines, Obits of Memorable British Columbians. It's from Harbor Publishing. Its author, Tom Hawthorne, joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.